Welcome again to the Cannabis Investing Podcast, where we speak with C-level executives, scientists, and law and sector experts to provide actionable investment insight and the context with which to understand the burgeoning cannabis industry. I'm your host, Rena Sherbel. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Great to have you listening with us, as always. Excited about the things that we are doing here at the podcast. Excited about all the people listening, all the people writing in. It really feels great to receive the kind of feedback that I've been receiving. It feels great to know that we've been helping so many people with their investments, trying to figure out the space a little bit better. And with that, we're for sure excited about our guest today, Nicholas Vita, co-founder and CEO of Columbia Care, which is a company I hope you've heard of, you might have heard of. It's been more medically focused. It's in a few states. We talked to Nicholas today actually about how he decided where to go first and where to continue going. They signed a big deal. They're now in Colorado. But Nicholas gets into those where those markets are heading that they're in and where they're looking to go further. We talk about Europe and what Nicholas sees there. Obviously, we've been talking on the show about the bearishness that has befallen Europe. But Nicholas and other guests we've had on talk about the strength of the European market, certainly on the medical side. Once it gets figured out, there's certainly a big market to be had there. And we talk about growing a company and how he feels about dilution and debt and how he sees running a company in the cannabis space. Really insightful points about who may be coming into the cannabis space, i.e. perhaps it's not your friendly CPG company, not your friendly alcohol and tobacco company. Perhaps it's coming from somewhere else. Nicholas makes great points and insights about that. And I hope you stay tuned because before the end of the year, we're going to be having our part two of the Masterclass in Cannabis Investing with Julian Lin and James V. Baker, two stalwart Seeking Alpha contributors who I'm super happy to have back for part two. And I'm super excited for you all to hear that. But until then, I hope you enjoy our conversation with Nicholas, get a lot out of it, and perhaps put Columbia Care on your watch list. And before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice of any sort. And in my model cannabis portfolio, I am long Trulieve, Chiron, Grow Generation, Curaleaf, Vireo Health, and Isracan Biosciences. You can subscribe to us on Libsyn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and Stitcher. Nicholas, welcome to the Cannabis Investing Podcast. Really happy to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So catch listeners up on your arrival to the cannabis industry. How did you get here and how did you get to Columbia?
So I'm one of the co-founders in addition to being the CEO, and I've spent a long time in financial services, both as an advisor and as an investor, and I'd spent most of my career in healthcare. And back in 2012, I began looking at the sector with a former colleague of mine from Goldman Sachs, and we made an investment. Turns out I ended up running that investment, and from there we decided to sort of create Columbia Care, and from that point we, I think, broke new ground at the time, and we were the first multi-state operator. And we've effectively went market to market, applying for licenses, winning them, building out the infrastructure, to where we are today with 18 markets in the U.S. and operations in the EU. And we're one of the quiet, but one of the largest sort of operators in the industry.
So, talk to me about your decision to go into the MSO space specifically. I mean, I imagine you had your choice of different cannabis, different ways to get into the cannabis space. How did you choose that space? And also, how surprised are you that you ended up choosing cannabis to get into?
Well, I think it's safe to say that at no point in my life did I ever expect cannabis to be a career choice. The fact that it is kind of a testament to how amazing the world really is. But the there are a lot of different ways to approach the industry. And what I learned from my experience in healthcare is that regulation can actually be your friend, especially when you're dealing with a controlled substance or an emerging market. And one of my job experiences was back in Eastern Europe after the wall fell, and I'd actually been involved with the transition from a sort of a planned economy to a market economy. And sort of all of these various experiences I had really pointed to the same kind of conclusion, which is you really want to have the ability to operate in an emerging market at the beginning to create something of scale. And so the idea was not to necessarily create a brand, because a brand without infrastructure in a market that is effectively ring-fenced by state doesn't really change things. And you know, one of the underlying themes that we were investing against as we built out ColumbiaCare is that the financial pressures at the state level would become increasingly meaningful to the elected officials and to regulators going forward. And so, you know, in that type of environment, the states which were preempting the federal government had a financial incentive to really create these ring-fenced operating environments. And I think that will continue to persist. It's only been exacerbated by COVID. So you had this massive existing market, which is very unique in an emerging setting, that is converting to a regulated market. And then you had this other confluence of events where you had policymakers making decisions based on fiscal need and budgetary realities. And so that's a very good place to be if you can be sort of a solution to some of the problems that the different constituents are looking at.
So talk to me about the decision to go into the first states that you decided to go into. How did you plan that out?
The first thing we did is we really looked at our initial experience. So my first experience in cannabis was Washington, D.C., which was a very, very small, limited market and a bit of an anomaly in the United States. So what people often think about is the way you can scale experience in cannabis early on. You really couldn't. So what you did in D.C. was completely irrelevant to what was happening in Colorado and California. But I like the idea of a limited license market. I like the idea of a medically focused market as a stepping stone to an adult use environment. I like the idea that you could you had rules and regulations that allowed you to do what you do, because the lack of certainty, the lack of clarity is what created risk. And you know, for me, the opportunity wasn't about how large of a company can you grow, how much of the market can you take. It was how can you do it without getting into trouble, because there was so little framework available both at the state and the federal level. So the first market we were in was really Arizona, and we chose Arizona because it was a regulated market. It was a medical market. It was a fairly sort of well-defined structure. It was fully integrated, so it allowed us to cultivate, manufacture, and dispense, and so we could have supply chain continuity and quality control, and it allowed us to touch our consumers. And so that was sort of the holy grail that we ended up using as the basis for every market that we invested in going forward. You know, we're fully integrated in almost all of our markets. We intend to be fully integrated in all of our markets, because that's the way you drive the most value, and that's the way you can really sort of create the most innovative products.
Are there ever times that you're looking at a state? I mean, you know, I want to get into the elections in a second and how excited you must be about them. But before the bullishness, is there ever a time where you're in a state where it's just not working out the way that you wanted it to, or it's just the regulations aren't going in the direction? Is there ever a time where you step back and think, you know, maybe we're going to step out of this and pivot into somewhere else?
You know, I think every state, when you build a business organically, every single new initiative, you always hit that point at some point along the curve. And so It's not an unusual sort of moment in time when you take a step back and you kind of reflect on what it is you're doing and why you're doing it. What we've learned is that there is an element of patience that you have to have, and you have to build it knowing that you're going to be able to become an agent that actually supports an outcome. And so by creating infrastructure, by creating scale, you actually end up earning a voice and a seat at the table with the decision makers who are actually determining what direction the policies wind up going in. Because employees and economic activity matter, and the way you operate your business in a compliant way also has an effect on that. So I'd say every single state we're in, we've sort of always sort of taken a step back and wondered, you know, are we doing the right thing? But we do that as just a matter of course, to make sure that we're not sort of blinded by our own passion and our own commitment. You know, we've only really exited two states in the company's history. We were very successful early on in Nevada, but Nevada was hyper-competitive and it was complicated environment. We just frankly thought it was the right time to kind of wait and see how that market shook out. And we exited Puerto Rico and for different reasons. But the other 18 states that we're in, you know, we're very committed to, and we're working forward. And we're actually, you know, who's to say we don't wind up opening up more facilities in Nevada, or we don't wind up going into sort of new states beyond the sort of the ones that we're in already. But it is, I think it's, it's such a dynamic environment. I think it would be disingenuous to say that everything's always unicorns and rainbows. You really do have to be sort of circumspect about everything as you take every step forward.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, in talking about the excitement around the success of these ballot initiatives that just happened in the last elections and states like Arizona going online and, you know, all that bullish sentiment and really for good reason in many respects. But I think also the question arises, okay, how does Columbia Care keep its footprint in these states, keep its stronghold in these states, while these other states are also, you know, getting it, while these other companies are also getting into these states? How do you keep that advantage when these states continue to go online?
I think it really comes from the way we built the company. Because we weren't a roll-up, because we built and hired people and grew human capital along with financial capital, we have the luxury of having a continuity of decision-making and the continuity of culture within the organization that really sort of reminds everybody what it is we do and why we do it. And ultimately, it's about service of the communities and the people who come through our front door and the people who buy our products. And that's something that's really important because, you know, it's hard to scale at the pace that we're scaling right now. I mean, we're growing, you know, 60% quarter on quarter, right? The top line, it's plus. And, you know, it's the same across, you know, almost every single market. Had we been a roll up and had we been forced to sort of think about integration as being the sort of the foundational elements of our organization, I think we would have more problems and more concerns than we do. But when you've worked with someone for years and years and years, and you've seen them grow up, and you've seen people's strengths and weaknesses evolve, and you've seen the organization evolve to accommodate the sort of the needs of the markets that we serve, all of a sudden you realize you actually have a really scalable platform. And that's what we're actually sort of seeing right now, which is we spent the first many years building out the infrastructure, hiring the people, developing the organization, and now we're beginning to see the fruits of those labor. And so, you know, I like to say that, you know, it's for us, it's never been a sprint. It's been, you know, a marathon. And we're now beginning to hit our stride, which is great to see because it was exactly in line with what we always told the market to expect. You know, you win the licenses, you build out the infrastructure, you preserve shareholder value so you don't dilute yourself in the process. And then you go to market and you commercialize. And that's exactly what we're doing now. So all of that infrastructure is waiting to be scaled up. And that's what we're beginning to see in the numbers.
And how much do you think, you know, your background contributes to that kind of business model and that emphasis on sticking to the business model? I mean, I guess along the way you saw, you know, the reason why, but I imagine that there were points along the way where you're like, wait, all these other companies are really expanding and they're getting a lot of, you know, interest and market share. And how hard is it to stick to that kind of more fiscally responsible way of doing things and more prudent way of doing things? And I guess how much does your background contribute to that?
Well, you know, I actually was involved in investment banking at Goldman, and, you know, I've had the opportunity to participate and advise on a number of mergers and acquisitions transactions. And the thing that you learn about M&A is that the headline is great, but the integration is hard. And the fastest way to destroy a great company is to get ahead of your skis. And there were a lot of times when we had very serious discussions about, you know, consolidating opportunities and cross-border transactions and you name it. And ultimately, we had to sort of look at ourselves in the mirror and say, how do we think we're going to be able to drive value for shareholders? And it required a lot of discipline and a lot of sort of soul searching. But, you know, I think where we are today is in a really good place because we're in enough markets and we're the market leader in most of our markets. So we've actually been able to accomplish all of the things other people are trying to accomplish. We've done it in multiple states because we've had more time to do it. The big difference here is that when I think about integrating a business into one of our organizations in a particular state or in a variety of states, I know the people who are going to be responsible for that integration. I know what they can do because I've seen them operate their own businesses. I've seen them solve problems. And so I think that it's the knowing that most M&A doesn't actually work out the way it's supposed to sort of caused us to be a little bit more cautious and to be a little bit more targeted. And now that we've sort of hit that critical mass, we can now open the spigot and begin to lean in a way that's going to be very difficult for others to compete with. I think a competitive market is good for everybody because it keeps people honest. But, you know, the market shares that we have, the leading market shares that we have, right? I mean, you know, being the number one player in New York, being the number one player in Colorado, being the number one player, you know, you go down the laundry list, and we're there. But the idea is not to sit on our laurels. The idea is to continue to lean in to really capture that market share and drive profitability, and frankly, drive the mission of the organization.
So talk to us a little bit about how excited you are in terms of these states continuing to go online and the ones that just went online. How do you see it progressing also?
Yeah, it is so fascinating because this is the only nonpartisan issue I'm aware of, right? I mean, it's like everyone agrees, you know, on the medical side, it's uniform. On adult use, it's maybe a little bit more controversial, but I think it's kind of moving to that point. You know, there were six Republican sort of senators that now represent states that have cannabis programs, right? So you have this meeting in the middle, which is really wonderful to see, because you know, who would have thought that cannabis would not only be a solution for fiscal issues, but also for political issues. I love the irony of that. But you know, we're in New Jersey, we're in Arizona, we're in, you know, of the 18 states we're in, 11 are expected to turn adult use in the next 24 months. And so we have an enormous amount of sort of work ahead of us to prepare for those conversions. You know, we're building out like crazy in New Jersey. We're hiring in New Jersey. We're doing the same thing in Arizona. And I think that's a really good place to be. You know, it's funny that the stigma that you had with cannabis just isn't there anymore. But again, it's a financial reality. And because we early on built our core operational base in the East Coast, those are the markets where you really have the most upside in the least developed markets. So as we transition from medical to adult use, you see what we experienced in Massachusetts, which is a staggering growth rate, and a transition away from the unregulated market to the regulated market, which I think is good because that means that people are using safer products, they're using better products, the tax revenue is going to the right place, and everyone sort of, I think, has a really high integrity and transparent relationship with the industry.
So when you're building out markets like more on the East Coast that you say that are less developed, you know, you're in Colorado and California, the number one and two markets. You just finalized this huge acquisition in Colorado. So you have, you know, investors know what to look for when you're talking about Colorado and California. How do you go about building out those other markets that are less developed?
Well, what I love about, because we spent so much time building the business organically on the East Coast, it gave us the opportunity to kind of be a little bit circumspect about the way the industry is developing. And one of our theories is that you really can't consider yourself a national leader unless you have a footprint in the leading markets. And Colorado is number two and California is number one, not just in the United States, but globally. So, you know, the combination with the TGS organization put us into that leadership position overnight in Colorado, and we've done nothing but increase market share and sort of drive financial performance by leaving the same leadership team in place and by really sort of supporting their activities. California is another fantastic sort of example because we have a core sort of platform in Southern California. We now are dipping our toe into sort of the San Francisco Bay Area. But more importantly, we have over 100 dispensaries, that are built into the relationship that the Project Cannabis team had, you know, sort of very, very sort of deliberately constructed over many years. And so, you know, it's not just about sort of the bricks and mortar that we have. It's about really penetrating and making our products available to a wide variety of products. And now that we have a fairly attractive portfolio of brands, we can actually take what we've developed and what has been developed in Colorado and in California and actually export it to Chicago, to Boston, to DC, to New York, to Miami. And so we can take all of these things that are just known as being very high quality sort of brands. We take form factors that are unique. We can take the IP that we're known for and that we've developed on the medical side, and we can basically come up with a portfolio of differentiated sort of not only form factors, but differentiated brands that are sort of specifically targeting parts of the market that we want to be the leader in.
And talk to me about West Virginia. You guys were one of a few companies to get a license out there. What's the reception been like to the cannabis industry so far out there?
You know, we love West Virginia. We're the leader in the Mid-Atlantic, right? And so there really isn't anybody else who has the same type of footprint that we do. And so for us, it was a very natural expansion into West Virginia. We've already had conversations. It's still a medical program. But we've already had conversations with a number of organizations that are involved in the fight against the opioid crisis down there. And, you know, I'm sure people who know me know that one of my one of my goals on my tombstone. I hope that it says this guy actually did something to try to break the opioid crisis, because it is a national disgrace. And cannabis, we've seen in the data we've actually collected from the research studies we've been involved with, our products work as a substitute for opioids in a variety of pain management settings. And so I hope that we go down to West Virginia and we bring the best products that are available in the United States to West Virginia. And in doing so, we actually give the providers and the policymakers another tool in their toolkit to not only provide a better quality of life to people who are looking for palliative treatments that cannabis is good for, but also can is as a weapon to fight the opioid crisis.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more in terms of the importance of that, and honestly, the excitement around the fact that people are open to that, and it looks like it's going to be able to really do something down there. Do you find like there's still a stigma around it in areas that don't have much of a legacy market? Do people still look at cannabis as, you know, a drug that they want to keep away from their kids type of situation? Or are you finding that less and less as the years go on?
You know, I guess it's a bit of both. We certainly find it less and less, but that voice, even if it is now becoming less pervasive, is really important to recognize. And I think that's one of the things I like to think about Columbia Care as representing. As passionate as we are about these issues, we never want to marginalize the dissenting voices. And I think that that's given us the ability, in a lot of communities that have been reluctant to sort of embrace cannabis, the willingness to let us sort of be their first shot. And, you know, I can understand why parents worry about their kids. I can understand why communities who've been ravaged by, you know, narcotics and by illegal drugs are worried about adding another potential vice into their communities. Like that makes sense. And it's our job to show how and why we are different and how we can actually help solve for some of those problems, not necessarily contribute to them. And that's, I would argue, that's one of the most important missions for everyone in the industry to think about, because this is not, if we want to create a sustainable industry, you know, I don't go to sleep worrying about whether or not more or fewer people are going to be interested in coming into our stores tomorrow. I know that they will, right? It's just the nature of the industry we're in. The real question is, can we do it responsibly, and can we do it in a way that is respectful of our investors, of our stakeholders, of our communities, and of our policymakers?
And do you find that when you meet people with that education and you know, kind of explaining exactly what you're saying, that it behooves everyone in the industry to explain that, but to explain the power of cannabis and you know, the healing properties, do you find that education leads people to change their mind? Like, have you ever encountered widespread opposition to that education?
I have many, many times. And you know, part of my job is to get beaten up, right? I mean, you know, if something goes wrong, it's always my fault. If something goes right, it's never my fault. And that's the role of the CEO, right? It's an inverted triangle. But the fact is, in fewer and fewer cases, this is still a controversial issue. And so I don't think that the pushback and the criticisms that the industry gets are unfounded. I think they're reasonable. I think, but you know, that's the nature of kind of doing something new. I mean, you know, we kid around at work because no one's ever really done this before. There are other people that are kind of doing it on the same timeline as us, but I can't open up a Jack Welch book and say, hey, guess what? On page 55, he experienced this, and you know, let's go out to the case study at Columbia Business School and see how they did this. It's really sort of white space, and so I think we have an opportunity to do things a little bit different than maybe other corporates might have because of the close relationship with the historical controversies. I think we can do it better than other industries have in the past, and frankly, that should be a differentiator for us going forward.
Yes, let's hope. You know, you talked about treating the community well. You talked about treating investors well. I'm interested, as CEO, your philosophy around, you know, there's a lot of talk right now about share dilution. I think we can both think of some examples of that off the top of our heads. Talk to me about your philosophy in terms of issuing debt and how you see that for investors in the company.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you something that's really funny. So for us, because we were so disciplined about M&A and disciplined about growing the business, Mike and I, who are the two co-founders, had a majority share, sort of a semi-control position in the company up until very recently. And so when we decided to sort of think about dilution, that was a very big decision. It wasn't just that we're diluting ourselves. It was we're actually giving up an enormous amount of control. And so when we think about, when we kind of fast forward and think about the way we construct the capital structure, you know, I was a distressed debt investor for a number of years, and debt is great until it's not. And, you know, I think what's different about us is that I've actually been on the other side as a debt investor that is actually exercising their rights in a downside scenario. So I didn't want to lever the balance sheet. I wanted to be very disciplined about the way we kind of create that efficiency of the capital structure. But the fact is we can find acquisitions and we can use our equity that such that even if it is dilutive, in terms of the actual absolute number of shares, it's accretive from a financial perspective. And so we're finding targets and we're finding opportunities that are just that far outweigh on a multiple basis of the type of dilution that our shareholders might otherwise experience as a result of that issuance. So it's an enormous amount of free cash flow, and that ship is coming towards us very quickly. So we have a little bit of debt right now, but the markets are expensive, right? There's an artificial cost of capital out there because we don't have access to the U.S. capital markets. And I think that compression and that, just frankly, that opportunity to kind of see that spread collapse when people begin to be valued on their financial performance or their financial characteristics, as opposed to the perception that this is still a quasi-legal industry, you're going to see an enormous amount of value created among the larger operators.
And how much do you think, you know, like the... institutional capital is coming in more and more, as we're seeing. How much do you think that is pushing things in terms of these onerous regulations that you guys have to deal with? How much do you think that pushes things to kind of improve and pushes maybe regulators to come on board and have some mercy on the cannabis companies? Or do you think that it's a matter of that, or that it's going to come in a different way?
I think that the regulators are just going to toe the line. I think that from an operational perspective, you see more and more flexibility, which is a great thing. And I think among state level policymakers, the same thing. For some of the, let's call it the quasi-governmental agencies like the exchanges, the financial institutions, the big banks, the money center banks that are regulated by the feds, I don't expect them to take any sort of change in policy until there is a formal change in policy, because there's no upside for them, right? They have such big businesses. I don't know why they would take the risk, the reputational risk or the operational risk, because they're so scrutinized right now. But the flip side is that from a fund flow perspective, that there's just the velocity of capital and the technical aspects of the sector. You know, we've seen already a significant increase in volume in our stock. And I think that's because the fundamentals sort of have really justified increased activity in owning our stock. But just as importantly, you know, as we begin to see a shift in policy at the federal level, people want to be ahead of that curve because when I say people, it's really the organizations that have more flexibility in their mandates. So you're probably more likely to see, you know, ultra high net worth individuals, hedge funds, and you know, retail investors sort of pick and choose their spots in the cannabis industry, because some of the large mutual fund complexes haven't been able to do that in size yet. Now, when that day comes, that's a completely different world, right? That's a real permanent capital base. And so I think that, you know, we're beginning to see some positioning ahead of that because the expectation is that whether it's a Republican or Democratic Senate or Republican or Democratic White House, you know, everybody agrees that this is an industry that needs to be normalized.
And how much time do you spend on lobbying those agencies or those regulators?
So I am fortunate. I am not good at it, so I don't spend personally a lot of time on it. I used to spend more time on it. Now I'm sort of, you know, I feel like my job continually shifts as the organization grows. But our company spends a fair degree amount of time on it, just to understand what the needs of the policymakers or the needs of our communities are. Because, you know, the way I view it is kind of simplistically, you know, if our mandate is to operate a business that is compliant and that sort of, you know, on behalf of the states that issue these licenses, it should be easy for us to go and talk to the people who are kind of overseeing the industry and say, what can we do for you? How do we be more helpful? And there's a very synergistic relationship there. And, you know, I think with the federal conversations, it's a bit more complicated. So, for example, I don't expect the exchanges to be as accommodating as some of the Canadian exchanges have been with smaller companies trying to list on their platforms, because, you know, there's a lot of risk. You know, you have to be Sarbanes-Oxley compliant. I mean, who are the companies that are going to be actually able to comply with the regulations to be a U.S. public listed company? Those are the ones that are probably going to be the natural beneficiaries. So as we convert from a Canadian listed company to a U.S. listed company, as we started adopting SOX compliance measures, and we started going through all that stuff, I mean, those are the things that are going to dictate who gets the trillion-dollar organizations looking at them from a platform investment perspective.
And over the next few years, do you think that that's going to play out in that way in terms of the companies will uplist or kind of the better companies will be separating? Or do you think that the regulations will work themselves out?
I think it's both. I think the regulations have to work themselves out in order for the bigger companies to uplist. And then there will be a kind of a risk assessment, a counterparty assessment by the, let's call it, by the exchanges or by the complexes to meet their requirements to be considered as a suitable kind of, you know, counterparty for their platforms.
And in general, is your thought and the thought process of Columbia Care, do you guys think it's going to be a state by state approach as opposed to, you know, a federal mandate type of thing?
I think the states will continue to preempt the federal government, but I think that there will be a federal mandate of some sort. Now, what that looks like is I think can go in 1,000 different directions. You're already starting to see the alcohol companies, and you're starting to see some of the alcohol distribution companies to position themselves at different state level conversations and within kind of the federal discussion. But ultimately, you know, the governors and the assemblies and the sort of the senates in each state and the regulators in each state have to look at themselves and say, if, you know, in New York, right? New York is a high labor cost environment. New Jersey is a high labor cost environment. If they begin to ship across state lines, that means someone from Colorado can ship to New York too. And I got to tell you, if that happens, there is no doubt that the group in Colorado that can grow outside 360 days a year is going to have a competitive advantage from a cost perspective and a productivity perspective. And so you're going to see a lot of economic dislocation in the states if they don't protect those markets. And so that's, I think, something that weighs heavily on the decision makers, especially as they're trying to figure out a way to kind of work their way out of this COVID crisis.
Yeah. It's definitely interesting to see how much COVID, I think, will affect things. Do you think COVID pushed the recent ballot initiatives? Do you think they pushed it in a bullish way at all? Or do you think it was going that way anyways?
I think it was probably going that way anyway, but I think COVID has helped. So for example, it's probably been more pronounced in some of the more developed markets like California or Colorado, because before there was a cultural familiarity with the illicit market in California. I think people kind of are waking up and saying, I really want my products tested and qualified. I don't want to go in and just, you know, assume that the guy in the panel truck is selling me something that is good as something I can get in a regulated facility. And so, you know, COVID has made people think about their own health in a different way than they ever have in the past, which I think is a good thing, because you really want people to invest in their own well-being. And frankly, you know, whether it's a deal versus the illicit market or versus the standard of care that a lot of pharmaceutical companies are manufacturing. I mean, you know, Oxycontin versus cannabis, are you kidding me? It's not even a fair fight. I mean, you know, it's so if someone has a problem, I think they're much more willing to think about a holistic sort of natural alternative that's effective first, whereas before they may not have, because it's now a regulated industry, because now there's testing required, because.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's been interesting this year with the vape crisis at the beginning of the year, and then with COVID, I think it's really pushed for people to understand the necessity of having a regulated market and how, you know, obviously important that is for consumers and patients to be able to get product that they know what's in there and that it's going to, you know, be good for them.
That's right. 100% agree.
Yeah.
100% agree.
Yeah. So, okay. So for some good news, we've had a lot of companies report, you know, really nice earnings, you guys among them, record numbers. Almost every number you look at, it's some kind of record. Talk to me about where you guys are at in terms of just announcing earnings and what you guys are looking at this coming year.
I'm going to sound probably a little bit unprofessional, but we are incredibly fired up for 2021. You know, the things that we needed to accomplish in 2020, we're on track to accomplish, and then some. And I am so excited about 2021 because if, you know, when I think about sort of the way we can begin to contribute to our communities, the way we can really sort of invest in our personnel and the way we can kind of deliver shareholder value, I feel like we're well positioned relative to anybody else. For better or for worse, you know, a lot of people still think about us as a medical company, yet, you know, we're in all the best adult use markets, and you know, we're gonna see those pops in our performance next year. And so I can't even begin to tell you how fired up I am. And I think the team is excited. And what's really amazing is that the team up and down. So it's not just like me and five other people that are fired up. It's you go and you talk to folks in the dispensaries that, you know, they're asking, well, hey, can we sort of work in California? You know, they're looking at Columbia Care as upward mobility and as a career, not just as a job to show up to every day. And that makes me really happy to be able to give people that type of opportunity. I mean, Lord knows I am not, back in 2012, I didn't know anything about the cannabis industry. But, you know, guys like Ben and Jerry, who were some of our original investors, took a flinger and they gave me a shot, right? They gave Mike a shot. And now we've got one of the biggest companies in the country, right? One of the biggest ones in the world. And, you know, that's the sort of thing, like that is the American dream that I want to continue to sort of push out into the organization and make sure that everyone knows that 2021 is not just going to be great for us as an organization, it's going to be great for the people who are kind of in the ecosystem. And frankly, it's going to be great for the industry.
Yeah, it's exciting. I mean, if you are a cannabis company that has been doing things well and right, I mean, I can't imagine a more exciting time to be involved with that. It's like everywhere you look, it's like, oh, this is happening and this is happening and this is happening and this is happening. It's really on all cylinders. I mean, I think fired up is, I do not want to call that an unprofessional term. I think that's quite professional.
Well, good, because that's a... unfortunately, that's like 30% of my vocabulary.
And very apt for the cannabis industry. Yeah. So talk to me a little bit. I mean, you guys have some operations in Europe a little bit. I'm curious to know your thoughts about that area of the world in terms of the cannabis industry. I mean, there was some bullishness in the past. It's dissipated. Certainly with COVID has echoed that disappointment. Where are your thoughts on that part of the world?
Look, I think Europe is a 3 to 5 year out story. It's going to be a great market, right? It's what is it, 700, 800 million people, and it's massive. But I think part of the reason why Europe had so much, they couldn't access the US. So all they could do is be in Canada or be in Europe. Now we're in Europe, but for us, it's a much longer path. I mean, the idea for us was that because Europe is going to evolve as really a medically oriented series of environments, that's super well suited for the type of intellectual property and product innovation that we've been sort of focused on for the past 8 years. And so that to us is an absolute no-brainer. It's one of the few things I can actually ship across international lines, which is intellectual property. And so, you know, we're looking at it very methodically, very slowly. We're involved in all the right political conversations. We've looked at every market and we're sort of, you know, picking and choosing our spots. But the economic reality today is that, and for the foreseeable future, is that a high growth, cash flow generating business, you've got to be in the U.S. and you've got to be a leader and you've got to be scaled. And that's why we spent, you know, we wanted to have our foothold there, but we really wanted to focus our efforts here. And when I think about the progression of Columbia Care, you know, back when we were, you know, there will come a time when everyone who's saying, why are you wasting any time in New York? It's a pilot program. And that's right, it is today. But New York has 20 million residents and a quarter of a billion visitors a year. When New York turns adult use, right, that's going to be a good place to be for New York State. And we intend to sort of be there to support New York State through that process. And that's something that, you know, a lot of folks just, you know, you saw it happen in Massachusetts. You saw it happen in Illinois. We've seen how big the California market is. I think Europe has a ways to go, but it's never really going to be like the US because it's just not part of the European culture in the same way it is in the US. But it will still be a good big market, but I think it'll require a much more medical focus.
Yeah, that definitely seems to be the consensus on the European market, which I think bodes well for you guys being there in terms of your experience there. Where do you guys see yourselves in terms of the broader ecosystem within the next 5 years? How do you see the industry kind of growing and where do you see yourselves growing with that?
So, I think that for us, I think we'll actually be growing at a disproportionate rate because of the infrastructure we've built out. We have a lot of capacity that we can scale into to help us drive down sort of costs, make our products more affordable, make our products better. We've spent a lot of time automating and getting ready for that. And then we've also spent a lot of time developing the right portfolio of brands and form factors that we'll be rolling out beginning in 2021. And so I think that the industry itself will continue to grow and expand, and it will become less of the Wild West than it has been. But you're probably going to see a bit of a bifurcation, likely to be sort of targeted or acquired. And that's just because there's a certain point where if you're a single state operator, you simply can't compete with the scale of a multi-state operator because you have the same requirements for finance, IT, marketing, compliance, and you need a revenue base to basically share those costs across the platform. But you know, I suspect you'll probably see an enlargement of the playing field. So instead of saying there are between four and six large players, they'll probably be between six and eight large players. And you'll continue to see a disproportionate access to the capital markets among those operators. You'll probably see a disproportionate amount of consolidation led by those players. And then I'm sure at some point when you see the sort of more traditional Fortune 500 companies get into the industry, they're going to be looking around to figure out what part of the space they want to be in. And so I think that will be, a very interesting moment in time when there'll either be consolidation, into the sort of those larger, more traditional organizations, or there'll be some very important partnerships that allow those relationships to be fostered.
Do you think there's a part of that, the bigger companies that have any kind of advantage in coming in and maybe acquiring, a cannabis company? Do you think like a CPG or alcohol or tobacco, do you think any of them have a leg up, or do you think it depends? It's very specific to who the people are involved and how they address the acquisition and how much time they spend in terms of getting to know the industry.
So I think that their advantage is their cost of capital and their access to capital. I mean, for anyone to think that they could compete with a Philip Morris or a Pfizer you name any of the large alcohol companies from a cost of capital perspective, it's not going to happen. And that is a massive advantage. And they're just bigger businesses. But here's where it gets really interesting. We're fully integrated. So we cultivate agricultural, we manufacture, we innovate, and we distribute. And then we also have wholesale relationships. So it's not only retail, but wholesale. Very few businesses have a fully integrated business model, either by regulation or by choice. And so, would CVS love to have, a cannabis dispensary element to their business? Sure. So would some alcohol distributors. Alcohol distributors would love to be in that middle piece, let's call it that center tier between, manufacturing and retail. Is it necessary? Probably not. It's kind of an artificial tax that people have to pay in alcohol because of historical reasons, but I'm not sure if cannabis consumers are going to be really excited about that. Are there healthcare applications? Absolutely. Are there CPG applications? Absolutely. But CPG companies don't really invent products anymore. They kind of buy smart products from other people. So, there's no natural fit necessarily with any particular business model because of where they've decided to sort of optimize their own operations, right? I mean, IBM used to make computers. Now all they do is really service computers. It's kind of interesting to see how that has happened. Now, there's something that no one has talked about that I think is kind of fascinating. So putting my investor hat again, if I were a private equity person looking for a multi-billion-dollar acquisition that is, hyper growth, hyper, attractive margins, that is, it can actually be split up and you can create value in 101 different ways where all the industry fundamentals are in place, I can't think of a better industry. So I think that the sleeper here is what no one's really been talking about, which is, why in the world wouldn't private equity want to get into a business like this? Because it actually fits the model for private equity, because they don't really have to be sort of the best operators in the world. They just have to sort of leverage the business and let the natural growth of the industry sort of continue to kind of populate the performance. So it's a really, I think that there are a lot of different sort of outcomes that are possible. The sort of the strategic mergers with like the Diageos of the world or something like that, I can't speak to any of that, but I will say my suspicion is that the boards of those companies and the senior executives of those companies that are managing those companies, they will have a very strong focus on reputation and on quality to make sure that if they do decide to get into a new business line or a new business or a new product line, it is accretive not only financially, but it's also accretive reputationally. And I think that's one of the big hurdles a lot of operators are going to have to struggle with, because you know people use inconsistent methods across states. They don't test their products in every state. You really have to find kind of a diamond out there in order to sort of qualify for that type of discussion.
That's really interesting. That's a really interesting take. Very well thought out take on the next few years. Speaking of the future, one thing that I really found interesting that you guys do is that you have this national card in Columbia Care. And I think that's a really interesting take on the future of retail, right? We certainly know that retail is changing, has changed. COVID has, you know, sped that up a little bit in terms of, you know, delivery and curbside and all of that. It seems to me like that's a nice take on the next phase of the cannabis retail space. What was the thought behind that and where are you guys kind of planning on going with that?
Yeah, so it's it was actually a crazy thought that everyone said, forget about it, it'll never happen. And we kind of just decided to put our heads down, and a member of our team just knocked the cover off the ball. And I mean, if I could tell you that it was like finding, imagine someone just took a giant box of Lego and dumped it in his lap and said, go build me the Mona Lisa or go build me a battleship. And that's what he did. And so we have, the idea was really simple. The single biggest obstacle to consumer adoption is actually the complexity of the transaction, right? It feels weird when you have to go in and pay cash for something. And it's actually not an inexpensive consumer purchase. And so, you know, you think about the dynamic there. If you have to go to an ATM and the ATM doesn't have, it only distributes up to $300, you know, even, you know, B2B, a lot of times in some of these, especially in places like California, if you make a delivery, they're trying to pay you in cash. It's completely awkward and arcane. You'll increase average basket size. Two, you'll increase loyalty because you can create loyalty programs around it. Three, you will find a way to actually make the transaction more efficient and more profitable for the business counterparties. And four, you'll basically create a uniqueness of the platform that will help you kind of sell through. And so we did it for ourselves to see if it worked. And what we saw is basket size went up, loyalty went up, repeat business went up, automatic fulfillment went up for home delivery. I mean, every single part of the business improved when we introduced the credit card. So based on that experience, and by the way, there was almost no bad debt. So it was an absolute home run from a risk perspective and an absolute home run from the kind of the call optionality that you just described on kind of being the only sort of consumer credit provider in the space. And it's a real credit card. It's not like some Bitcoin transaction that goes to Kazakhstan for 20 nanoseconds and comes back. It's actually a real credit card. So we've actually been able to roll it out to most of our states at this point and have had the same type of impact in each one of those states. And based on that, we've actually forged a number of relationships with other companies that we're going to be introducing this card into. So it's not going to be the Columbia card, it'll be the cannabis card, right? And we've rebranded it, it looks amazing. But that transition has not happened yet because we, you know, during the beta test, we actually had it on our balance sheet and we're shifting it off onto private capital now that is more well suited. And frankly, it's, you know, I'm not a credit card guy and Columbia Care isn't a credit company. So we really wanted to have a discrete business that did this only. It'll still be majority owned by Columbia Care, but it's going to be split off and basically turned loose on the entire industry to basically create a sort of a unique platform for the consumers and frankly for business B2B relationships.
That's really awesome. That's really cool. I love that it started with a crazy idea. That's always the way that the best ideas start, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Is there?
Tell me you're done, you're done. I will lean in. Yeah.
Did somebody say crazy? Do you hear from other companies like interested in copying that at all? Or
yeah. We've got five groups that actually want to put it on, and you know, back to kind of the roots of the of sort of where we come from. We just don't want to stretch ourselves, and so I have to make sure that the capital is in place to take it to make sure that doesn't have any direct impact on Columbia Care, so that it can be managed independently. I think we could probably figure it out, but our core business is still our core business, and I think that if you put it into the hands of people whose only job it is to sort of flex in and run that credit card, I think that'll be a much more successful sort of enterprise long term So, you know, the rate limiting factor is actually us and our willingness to sign people up, but we've had a lot of interest, and I think everyone recognizes the value and utility, because I mean, who wouldn't want their AS, you know, the average, the average basket size to go 25% overnight? It's just, you know, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, it sounds like a win-win also for customers. It sounds, you know, like a great idea. Well, Nicholas, we're getting to the end. Anything you want to leave listeners with or give advice to investors on this wild ride? Anything you want to share before we go?
You know, the only thing I would say is we're still at the beginning stages. I mean, this is truly an emerging market. It's just very rare that you get to the opportunity to see an emerging market develop in a sort of a developed market environment. I mean, this is sort of one of the great opportunities of our lifetimes to sort of create some interesting case studies and to see how business can be built. But what I really love about it, it's also one of the first times in my memory where individual investors can actually get that call option on the growth of the industry before the institutions can. And so that's kind of a very unique phenomenon, a little bit backwards, because the institutions simply cannot invest. And so if you believe in the thesis of the industry and you found a company or two that you really like, that you think are sort of disciplined stewards of capital, there really is effectively an opportunity to be in front of or ahead of a lot of the large institutions that ultimately will need to have positions in the industry, because it's a big enough sector within consumer products or healthcare or however it's defined for them to want to spend time on it.
Absolutely. Could not agree with that more. Nicholas, this has been really edifying. I really appreciate your insights. You've shared a tremendous amount with us. I really appreciate it. And I hope you come back on the show down the line.
Great. Thanks so much for having me. It was great to meet you.
Thanks so much for listening to the Cannabis Investing Podcast. Subscribe or follow us on Seeking Alpha, Libsyn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or Stitcher. And we'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps other investors find our show. If you have feedback or questions, we'd love to hear from you at rena+canpod@seekingalpha.com. That's RENA+CANPOD@seekingalpha.com. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time.